The East-West Corridor, which does go through Central Asia and to the Caucasus and then on Turkey and Europe, it's going to be very important, unquestionably. But if you want to set your watches, start thinking about the corridor from Central Asia to India, to South Asia, to the Arabian Sea. That is the big sleeper. The minute that is open, these countries are going to be dancing with joy because they suddenly have reopened their what was for 3,000 years one of their main links with the outer world.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtime, en podcast fra Tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Fredrik Starr. He is the founding chairman of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute and Silk Road Studies Program, a joint transatlantic research and policy center affiliated with the American Foreign Policy Institute in Washington and the Institute for Security and Development Policy in Stockholm, which is our neighboring country, by the way. This is a podcast in this year's series about the countries around Russia, their history, their relationship with Russia, and their future. And today's topic will be Central Asia more generally. And that said, Central Asia is, at least in our conversation here, five states. Kazakhstan, a very long border with Russia. I've read that the border with Russia is almost as long as the border between Canada and the United States. And then the Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. And first of all, welcome and thank you for joining me today, Fredrik.
Thank you. Pleasure to do so.
I'll just start with a quote that you wrote in 2022. And it started like this because I think it gives us a general picture of what is going on in this area. And you write, since their independence from the USSR, the five Central Asian states that emerged from the wreckage of the Soviet Union in 1991 have been the object of great power dreams. Russia, with steady persistence, has tried to lure them back into the sphere of influence, if not of direct control, through economic and security alliances. The United States and Europe have worked to develop them as market economies and to implant civil society and democratic institutions there. Meanwhile, China assigned them a key role in its Belt and Road Initiative and loaned them billions to develop economic strengths that complemented Beijing's own. So this is actually a quite important part of the world. And unfortunately, I myself and probably my listeners don't know the details about this region. So I think it's a good start for you to go through the recent history of this region and also, of course, mentioning the different countries, because as I said, these are five countries in this area.
Well, let me first say that Scandinavians have a very ancient connection with this part of the world. Vikings got down there, traded with them, and you find coins from this part of the world in various Viking hordes in Norway and Sweden and in Denmark. So it's not terra incognita to Norwegians if you take a long view. Now, with regard to the five countries, of course, that's defined in terms of those countries that were formerly part of the USSR. In other words, it's a post-colonial definition. Now, with 30 years later, we'd change the definition of Central Asia. We would certainly add Afghanistan, because for 3,000 years, it's been part of the same cultural, intellectual, economic zone, and it isn't right now, but who knows what it will be in 10, 20 years. And we would also we'd cross the Caspian and add Azerbaijan. Why? Because absolutely the same interests, same cultural, general cultural orientation, and very conscious of having common interests with the rest of Central Asia. So I would start by saying that the area has greatly expanded since the collapse of the USSR.
And since you are defining this area, including those other countries as well, of course, we can agree to that. They are all part of an area, partly part of the USSR when it was the USSR and partly independent. But anyway, as you said, it is a region without any coastal line, for instance. It's also mountainous and it's a bit, you can say it's part of a geographic area as well that you also describe in one of your articles, how this might differ and how this this gives them different economic possibilities, resources, for instance. So maybe you can go through those parts of, economic and political, and how that influences, for instance, the differences between those countries and the similarities.
Well, first of all, I think you've just touched on one of the key issues. What defines this area is partly negative. It's landlocked. And in the case of Uzbekistan, double landlocked. It's surrounded by landlocked countries. Being landlocked is not good. And the major objective these countries have is breaking out of their landlocked status. Central Asia as a region under Russian imperial control, under Tsarist and Soviet control, the Russians wanted all transport to go through them. So there were links to north to Russia, but nowhere else. Now the Chinese have opened up links to the east, and we're busy opening up links to Europe. But the most important, arguably, or one of the most important links is to the south. They are absolutely shut off from direct transport links with India, Pakistan, the entirety of Southeast Asia. So one of the big goals they have, not only for economic purposes, but for reasons of sovereignty, maintaining independence, is to get that fourth window open to the south. And that's where Afghanistan comes in.
So how do you, if we go through them country for country, their politics, economics, their status situation right now, because even though we treat them as a group of countries, there are individual differences.
There are individual differences. Let's begin with language. Five of them, of the seven, have Turkic languages, but they're quite different from each other. A Kazakh has trouble understanding an Anatolian Turk. And by the way, we should think of going east too from this region beyond the Soviet border, because you have these 15 million Uyghurs in China, Western China. They are part of the same cultural zone. And by the way, Uyghur is the oldest Turkic language. So they're really an honored position, even though they're under very ruthless Chinese rule for now. Now, their general interests are, it's very interesting, as a new country, all new countries, when Norway was established as an independent state, and after its kerfuffles with Sweden and all, was very conscious of protecting its sovereignty. The United States, after independence from Britain, very focused on its sovereignty. All these countries, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, their first concern was to consolidate their own sovereignty. Now, very important, that period has passed. They've done it successfully. They all exist, some better, some worse, but they all exist and are sovereign. So now, a very, very interesting and important era is beginning, and that is they are beginning to link arms with each other, just as the Nordic Council links arms. And has been done so very, very effectively, or ASEAN in Southeast Asia. They are groping toward this in Central Asia. I say groping because the Russians oppose it. Russians love the old Roman principle, Julius Caesar, divide and conquer. Therefore, they're not eager to see these Central Asians link arms with each other, even though they're the only region in the world without its own regional organizations. But that's that, in terms of what are their interests today, that's one of the important ones, to link arms, be more effective internationally. And, of course, if you're a Norwegian investor and want to do something in one Central Asia country, it'd be a lot more efficient to be able to do two or three at once. And they aren't organized for that yet.
Yeah, because I also looked up before this talk that what are the countries that Norway has connections with, like embassies or things, and that seems to be very much linked to economic possibilities, but not with all of them.
Absolutely, yes. But I have to say that not only Norway, but Scandinavian countries generally, and I would add emphatically the Baltic countries, have very good reputation in Central Asia. I know Statoil, I know the various Scandinavian and Norwegian energy companies have been involved at one time or another. But in general, it goes beyond specific investments. They are viewed with a good deal of respect as, in some sense, models.
So we can go into also, I think, which this because this is the topic of this series. It's the, as you just mentioned, they are striving, and first, of course, they became independent countries. Then they were preoccupied with building their identity as individual countries, apart from the earlier Soviet Union. And you just said that because they are grouping up or they're linking together now, the Russians, they don't like that. So can you, if, for instance, the first country, the one with the longest border, the biggest by far also, the Kazakhstan country, how is the relations between those two countries, Russia and Kazakhstan? And also, as you, as we know, with the, this long border, it must be quite difficult. If you, at some hypothetical thinking, should wanted to close the border, it would be a very long border to close.
Well, after independence, the first concern was obviously to protect their borders. The Kazakhs were very concerned about this. Therefore, they moved in their capital to the center of the country where it could kind of stand guard. And Astana is a new city built to defend, in a sense, territory. The all the countries of the region are, of course, they're very concerned with protecting sovereignty and all that. But nowadays, they're getting much more sophisticated in terms of their objectives. They are talking to each other. They are creating organizations with each other. But, you know, it was just the same in terms of relations with Russia. Think of Norway when it was under Swedish rule. After that, you did not adopt Swedish as a national language. And similarly, the Kazakhs are eager not to get rid of the influence of Russian, which is far, far, far different from Kazakh than Swedish and Norwegian. But all the countries of Central Asia are emphatic about using their language and rediscovering their history, their culture. And they want to do this together, not just as six or seven solo countries.
And you also say, I'm not an expert, obviously, in this area, but how are the, are there differences in between them? I mean, like you say, they might look upon Russia the same way, since they were all of them, all, well, at least five of them earlier, part of the Soviet Union. But what could be, are there any specific conflicts in this area between those states that you would like to talk about and tell us about?
There, there have been tensions and conflicts, but frankly, the most recent one was a kerfuffle along the Tajik-Kyrgyz border near Afghanistan, actually. And this boiled along for 6 months or a year, and at times they were throwing bricks at each other, and then they were shooting a little bit, but they resolved it. And interestingly, in the last month, not only did they resolve it, but they resolved it without outside help. So at this point, I think it's fair to say that there are no real conflicts among these countries. And to the extent there are differences of interest, they're able to work them out by head-to-head meetings.
Hmm. So let me add
another thing.
Yes, yes, of course.
And speaking about Central Asia, especially in the enlarged sense that I was suggesting is the new reality, which includes Afghanistan and Azerbaijan. In speaking about that Central Asia, you really are talking not just about a bunch of countries today, but an ancient and deeply rooted cultural zone. Why? Because this was the heart of what we mistakenly call the Silk Road. The Silk Road, we think of Chinese carrying goods to Europe. That didn't happen. They did carry some goods to Central Asia, and then the Central Asians took them west to Europe and the Middle East. But actually, the Central Asians controlled the whole thing. They were, and not only were they shipping goods in every direction, especially India. We never talk about that. We think Silk Road, that means China. No, at least as much it meant, or more, it meant India. And that's the window they want to open today again. Well, the Central Asians were not passive crossover zone. They were not just the land of desert that you cross with a camel caravan to get to somewhere else. No, it was a center itself. That's where all the business was centered, manufacturing in metal, steel, in cotton cloth and weaving and all that. All this was centered in Central Asia, and even the insurance business for all these caravans. You don't send 500 camels across the desert without insurance. And that was all done from Central Asia. So they all look back, for all their differences of language and even physical differences among them, some looking more Asian and less, others less. When, in spite of all that, they recognize their common heritage. And that's why I wrote the book Lost Enlightenment. And interestingly, every language in the region has its translated version of that book, because it sets forth their who are we as a group, not just as solos.
Mm. Yeah, it's a very interesting title and very interesting. I must admit, I haven't read the book yet, but it seems very interesting to go through this area and seeing it in this light that you are now describing. And you also, but we also in this little piece that I quoted you from, you said that the Belt and Road Initiative, and I mean that is the popular and modern version of the Silk Road, it was also accompanied by loans, billions of loans from Beijing to these countries. So do you think that the power balance has kind of tipped over to the Chinese now in respect to what you just said about the Central Asia countries being much more central than we thought historically?
Well, yes, I think that's certainly true. The Chinese have played a very strong hand in the last few years. And frankly, they've taken advantage of Russia's weakness and of the West's relative passivity. But that said, the Central Asians are very prudent people. And they understand not only the possibilities of cooperation with China, but also the dangers. They're very sober about it. And so there is a there today. There is a there today in Central Asia. They confer with each other. They coordinate very quietly and quite effectively. So I think what's happened is not that one or another or a group of external powers is taking control in the region, but that the region itself is gradually, it's a difficult process, but gradually taking control of its own fate. Hmm. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's and we are talking about a huge, huge geographical area here. It's not small. So when you look at a map, you might get the misconception that this is not a big area, but it is. So but what we can go into now is, of course, what has anything and what are the most important things, if any, and I think there might be something that changed when Russia attacked Ukraine 2 years ago. How did that affect the area? And can you tell me a bit about the things that, for instance, as we also know, the relationships between Russia and China, and also, of course, in this region, how this inflicts them and what is happening?
The Russian invasion of sovereign Ukraine has had a decisive and irreversible impact on Central Asia and the Caucasus. Russian publicists and bureaucrats have made no secret of their desire also to reacquire Central Asia and the Caucasus. They've been very blunt about it. And the Central Asians understand this. They're not naive at all. The first thing that Russia's invasion of Ukraine did was put them on guard. That it killed any illusions they may have had that they could come to some productive relationship with Putin's Russia. The second thing, though, is much more curious, and that is, they are now aware of Russia's weakness, and which is on display every single day. We argue always, who's winning in Ukraine? Unquestionably, the Ukrainians are, because the Russians have been pushed back to very far, and they've tried three or four times to launch new waves of conquest in Ukraine. Every time they've been stopped dead. So I think the Central Asians are now, this has empowered them. It's made them less hesitant in linking arms with each other and developing complex relations with the rest of the world and not just with their former colonial overlords.
Yeah, so the fear of Russians coming into that region again has made them step up.
Yeah, exactly. And no one thinks that the Russians could pull it off. Mm. Even in Ukraine, suppose through some absolutely unimaginable process, Russia were to take over Ukraine the next day. Half of Ukrainians would have become guerrilla fighters. There's no way Russia can control, even if it claimed all of Ukraine, there's no way they could control it. And even less would they be able to control Central Asia. So history has moved on. Mr. Putin is stuck in the past. He's temporary. The question is, what is a new Russia going to look like? That's the big question that everyone asks.
what do you think that the Central Asians think that the other Russia, the new Russia, will look like? What do they?
They're very, very cautious. They're not optimistic at all, but they're hopeful that a better Russia can emerge. But let me report a little exercise. We at the Central Asia Caucasus Institute commissioned 24 very, very fine writers, analysts, politicians, diplomats worldwide to each of them to write a couple of pages on what they expect Russia's future to be. they were all over the map. So if you ask the same question in Central Asia, you'll get as many different answers as the number of people you ask. However, generally, they are very prudent, very cautious. They know Russia isn't going to go away, that they're going to have to deal with Russia, and that they hope it might be possible to come to a constructive way of doing that and not one that puts their sovereignty at stake.
So, and also, we mentioned briefly China, and of course, apart from the Belt and Road Initiative, how do they look upon China? Because you also, of course, we included Uyghurs in this area, and that is, of course, a troublesome thing for Westerners when we look at human rights and all those things happening to them inside of China. So, how is China playing a role here, politically and economically? Connecting to, of course, also the Belt and Road Initiative, but other things as well, if you have other comments.
Well, there are many Chinas. There are the private companies that come storming in and doing things, some of them very well, some of them embarrassingly badly. Then there are the big state initiatives like the Belt and Road. And then there's the security issue. Russia has tried to dominate Central Asia's security arrangements, but now China's moving in on that, and maybe the West is beginning to, too. Now, I think in general, the deep cultural difference between China and Central Asia, again, Central Asia is a 3,000-year-old culture that at many for many centuries led the world, not just Inner Asia, led the world in intellectual and other development. So they're conscious of who they are. And therefore they're very, in the end of the day, very prudent, correct, but prudent in dealing with the Chinese. They try to benefit from what they can. It's not always easy to maintain control. Tajikistan, for example, is so deeply in debt to China, as is Kyrgyzstan, that it's hard to imagine how they're going to dig themselves out of the hole. But with those exceptions, the Central Asian countries have done pretty well in preserving their identity, their existence.
So if you can just think about how the future in this region will be, we briefly mentioned also the importance of what you call a South Corridor, which is, of course, the access to the sea, and we started out with that. But that goes through some countries as well. I mean, you cannot just go directly from Kazakhstan and down to the Indian Ocean. So there are relations there as well. So how do you see the future of this region? You can think about it as, well, economics, politics, and maybe also global importance.
Well, first of all, I'm very optimistic about its future for a very simple reason. These are smart people. They have a deep, deep intellectual tradition. They're religiously very tolerant. I mean, it's hard to find another Muslim society that is as tolerant as the Central Asians and Azeris. So they're open-minded. These are open, increasingly open societies. So I'm optimistic in the long run. Now, you focus on transport. That is right to do. It is the key issue du jour, but it isn't the only one. And the East-West Corridor, which does go through Central Asia and to the Caucasus and then on Turkey and Europe, it's going to be very important, unquestionably. But if you want to set your watches, start thinking about the corridor from Central Asia to India, to South Asia, to the Arabian Sea. That is the big sleeper. The minute that is open, these countries are going to be dancing with joy because they suddenly have reopened their what was for 3,000 years one of their main links with the outer world.
And also, of course, it will greatly influence their perceived dependence on Russia and the way the transportation
exactly.
will go.
Oh, exactly. Indian business people, they'd love to do business in Central Asia, but you know, if you can't get there.
Apart from the people living there, what are the most important resources for the future in this region that they might be useful and that they might use for building up economically viable societies?
Well, they have every conceivable resource. Oil, gas, we all know about that. Huge deposits. But there's also all the minerals in the mineral chart are available somewhere in Central Asia. So there's that. Also agricultural products, cotton, obviously, but not just. Wheat. Kazakhstan may well become one of the major wheat producers in the world. However, having said that, I think we have to also think about the resources they don't have. And there is one huge one, and that's water. Mm. Now, if you want to be pessimistic about Central Asia, if you want to take a gloomy long-term view, look at water. Mm. Why? All the water from Central Asia comes out of the mountains, the Tian Shan Mountains, the Pamir Mountains, that basically between China, Pakistan on the one side, and Afghanistan and Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan on the other. In other words, there's this huge north-south mountain range that connects gets you to K2. Second highest mountain in the world, and eventually it carries you all the way to Everest. Now, that is where all the water comes from. If you drink a beer in Bishkek or in Ashgabat, the water for that beer comes from those mountains. And the mountain glaciers that feed them are gradually eroding. Gradually melting. And the Soviet agricultural industry was extremely wasteful of water, extraordinarily wasteful. So they have to, on the one hand, completely redo their irrigation systems, start saving water. They have to move away from crops that take a lot of water. Then they have to be much more prudent in their use of water in cities. But even then, that's not going to solve the problem. And the mother of all issues of Central Asia in the future is water. Now you say, well, what about energy? Well, yes, maybe you can use all solar power that they do have. They're building up very fast. They have vast amounts of gas and oil. Maybe they can use that somehow to get water, but that's not clear yet. And they're just now beginning to focus seriously on this mother of all problems.
Hmm. So I wasn't expecting to start to finish the conversation on this gloomy prospect, but of course water is very, very important, and as you say, it's a large area, and if you should look at the map again and geography, it will be hard to find other places to find water for this region.
Well, it is a huge problem. However, what I've noticed in the last year is that, first of all, they are no longer looking to international organizations and banks and so on and countries to solve the problem for them. This is a fundamental shift. They are taking charge of their water problem. And they're doing it with Afghanistan, by the way, with Taliban, because Taliban is threatening to use a huge amount of water from one of the two main rivers. So they are taking charge of their own water problem. That's very good news. And second, these are very sophisticated and resourceful people. And it is entirely possible that once they really focus on it and engage the rest of the world in solving that problem, they may come up with solutions that we can't even imagine today. So the game isn't over. And the gloomy prognostications that one might make on the water issue, I think, are very premature, and there's still plenty of room for optimism.
So you are in, to finish it off, to say that you are quite optimistic when it comes to the future of this region, apart from the water. But then finally, politically, because this region is not like famous for being liberal democracies all over the plate. It's at least some of the countries are really run by what we in at least in Norway, probably also in the United States, of course, we'll call them dictators. So what do you think are the political prospects of these countries?
Well, that's a legitimate and real concern. And it's not a concern only shared by outsiders from Norway and the United States and heavens knows where. It's shared by many people within the region. And I think what we have to understand is that their, if you will, authoritarian rule that exists in many of the countries, highly centralized, one guy in control, that this was almost inevitable for weak and fragile countries. Their concern was for the country to survive to the next day. And as they calmed down a little bit, as the situation is ameliorated, and as the Russian threat, as I think it will eventually subside, as this happens, I think you will see much more moderate forms of government. Legal reforms in several of the countries are taking place. They're quietly going forward, and the courts are being improved. They're sending people abroad to study in Europe and America, the legal processes and so on. So I think this, what we have seen, of course, there is a tradition of strong individual rulers in that part of the world. But I think what we have seen is largely an effect of threats to their sovereignty as new states and as they become more self-confident and as a new generation comes to the fore, you're going to see much more evidence of openness.
Oh, thank you for that, because that's at least some optimism going on here. And we are a liberal think tank, Civitas, so of course we would like to hear about democratic and liberal developments in this area as well. But anyway, thank you so much for your time today, Fredrik. And I will recommend, and you might do it yourself, where to buy your book.
Oh, Lost Enlightenment, which is really an introduction to this region's golden age, 1,000 years ago. Fascinating stuff these people were doing, just amazing stuff, measuring the earth more accurately than until the 17th century, hypothesizing the existence of North and South America as inhabited continents. Imagine 1,000 years ago, creating the medical field. And then in addition to Lost Enlightenment, new book just came out, Oxford Press, is entitled The Genius of Their Age. And it talks about two superstars who lived 1,000 years ago who were on the highest world level of geniuses. And they're absolutely sons of this region. So The Genius of Their Age. It was fun to write.
That's great. I think that's a good opportunity for the listeners to get more knowledge about this area and look into what Fredrik has written. So thanks a lot, Fredrik, and for joining me. You are in the United States, I'm in Norway, and we were talking now about the region even further east. So for time zones, I won't even calculate what we have been covering right now. So anyway, if you like Liberal Halvtime, you must rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using my name or my email, matilda@civita.no, or my colleague, eirik@civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtime, en podcast fra Tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.